Good evening.
Welcome to the Friday night review of Approaching the Buddhist Path. Venerable Chodron is away for the next couple of weeks. She's doing some teachings in New York and also in London. So we'll be doing some reviews in her absence. And so let's begin, as usual, by cultivating our motivation for our time together tonight. Lately, I've been giving more thought to what it actually means to have a precious human rebirth. A life of freedoms and fortunes, or leisures and endowments, however you choose to translate it. It's difficult to obtain because of the causes, all the myriad causes that we must create. And with this precious life, we have the opportunity to benefit ourselves and to benefit others, both in this and future lives. And so, of course, we can think about developing our good human qualities. That's certainly something we aspire to do. But also, we as Buddhists are so fortunate that our spiritual goals are very clear, at least the long-term goals, and probably each of us have our own short-term goals as well. But to think about creating the causes for a good future rebirth. So many people don't even give that a thought, don't even know that's something to aspire for. And also liberation and full awakening. Some people don't even know that's a possibility. So we are so fortunate to have the precious human rebirth we have right now, and also have clear teachings on the causes that we need to create to continue, for our continuum to continue with good rebirths, aiming for these long-term goals of liberation and full awakening. These freedoms and fortunes are difficult to come by because it requires creating pure ethical conduct supported by the other perfections, as well as stainless aspirational prayers. And all of these are difficult for us to practice consistently, regularly, persistently. But again, we're most fortunate that we have human intelligence. And that would include things like having interest in spiritual pursuits and being free of wrong views, having our sense faculties and mental faculties intact. We're so fortunate that we have this human intelligence. When we were receiving teachings from Geshe Thabke on Pramana Vartika, He said very clearly, we don't think of it as difficult to obtain, this precious human rebirth as difficult to obtain, because it's always been there. But he said if we understood how difficult that it was to attain it, we wouldn't waste a minute. Otherwise, we'll think, well, I'll do this other thing instead of Dharma. But he reminded us that if we really understood how rare, how precious, how unique this life is for each of us, then we'd be sure to make good use of it. And one aspect I like to think about is how meaningful this life is, and we can think about that in different ways, but the one that really speaks to me is this life is meaningful in every moment. Every moment we have a choice of how we use our mind, how we use our body and speech. And in every moment we can turn our mind, or we have the opportunity to turn our mind to virtue. So tonight, let's make use of our precious human rebirth by listening to the teachings and reflecting on them, discussing them with each other. We're so fortunate to and have spiritual friends to discuss the Dharma with. And then taking them to the cushion to meditate on them, to really deepen our understanding, our integration of this fact of our preciousness, the preciousness of our human existence right now. In our study with Venerable Children, we've reached Chapter 11 in Approaching the Buddhist Path. And however, in our review classes, we're still back on Chapter 3. So this chapter is called Mind and Emotions, and it gives a broad overview of the mind in both its positive and not-so-positive aspects. So in this chapter, His Holiness contrasts emotions from Buddhist and scientific points of view, contrasts constructive and destructive emotions, virtue and non-virtue, happiness and unhappiness. There's also a section on working with afflictions, contains 16 antidotes that Venerable Damcho walked us through. That was very helpful. And then last time, Venerable Nima led us through a beautiful explanation of the Metta Sutra when we were talking about love. So tonight I thought to focus on compassion. This is on page 61 of our book, Cultivating Love and Compassion. And it's kind of an overview at this stage. He's been talking about developing positive states of mind and also how to work with antidotes for some of the more challenging states of mind. So compassion is closely related to love, the wish for others to have happiness and its causes. These are like two sides of the same coin. So in the Buddhist tradition, love is the wish for all beings, self and others, to have happiness and its causes. Compassion is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering, all levels of suffering. And I think it's important to note that in the Sanskrit, Pali, and Tibetan language, the word for compassion implies feeling this for oneself as well as for others. I was reading a book by David Richardson. Is that his name? Yeah. Richie Davidson. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. And he was making this point because actually His Holiness made this point that in English, when we talk about compassion, we might assume that that's compassion only for others. But he was very clear to make that distinction that this word compassion, at least in these other languages, really includes compassion for self and others. And I also like the way Dr. Russell Coltz describes compassion in An Open-Hearted Life, the book that he and Venerable Chodron co-authored. He says, compassion is a sensitivity to suffering and the motivation to help alleviate it. I think that's quite poetic in a way. So a sensitivity or concern when confronted with another's suffering is an openness to being moved in the face of pain and suffering. This means that, according to this definition, to be compassionate, we allow ourselves to be touched, to be moved, to bear witness to the difficulties that we and others face. And due to being moved by that suffering, then we're motivated to help alleviate that suffering, to help make things better if we can. In the kindness retreat last year, I remember something that Venerable Jigme shared with us, and it was an important distinction between empathy and love and compassion. Do you remember that? She was talking about the scientific research that has confirmed that the brain, or maybe more specifically, the cerebral networks activated by meditating on love and compassion are very different than those that are linked with empathy. When we see someone suffering and our empathy is stimulated, cerebral networks associated with pain and distress and negative emotions are activated. And this explains why it's actually painful to observe someone who's suffering. No wonder we kind of recoil, pull away from it. When we witness the pain and suffering of someone else, we activate networks that underlie those very same feelings in ourselves. Maybe not to the same extent, but to some degree. But meditating on compassion and love activates brain circuitry associated with positive emotions, such as warmth and joy, and gratitude, resilience, contentment. So compassion seems to mute the empathic distress that can lead to emotional exhaustion and burnout that happens sometimes to people in caregiving professions. So from the Buddhist point of view, we can say that compassion is quite upbeat. Why is that? Because compassion is the wish to free others from their suffering and its causes. And in general, the causes of suffering can be eliminated, can't they? So that's a very upbeat message. I suppose, to be honest, we'd have to say if some karmic seed was ripening and someone was experiencing suffering, well, it's a little bit too late to antidote it at that point. Maybe there are other conditions that can be stimulated that help to alleviate that suffering, but that suffering's already ripening, you know, giving rise to its result. But how we can alleviate suffering is to work with our minds to reduce the afflictions and to antidote the specific non-virtuous states of mind and actions, and then eventually, in the long term, to eliminate all the causes of suffering. So it's important to think about compassion primarily as a mental attitude. We might think of it more as an action, but here in the Buddhist presentation, it's more of a mental attitude. It may manifest as an action or a behavior, but it's not our behavior, it's a state of mind. Compassion is a positive quality of mind that can be cultivated. And I like the way Dr. Richard Davidson speaks about it. He talks about it like a mental skill that we can train, that we can increase, that we can improve. And I think that's a very encouraging thing for all of us, that in fact, because of the very nature of our mind, it can be developed limitlessly because of the clear light nature of our mind as a basis for it. In fact, a lot of the research on compassion that I've had a chance to look at talks about, there have been research projects that include long-term meditators, people who have meditated literally for years on developing deep states of love and compassion. But also what's encouraging is that in many of these research projects, they have not a control study, but another group where they might teach a short course of how to meditate on compassion, and they give them the assignment to meditate on it for 30 minutes every day for 2 weeks. And they still see statistically significant changes, both in the brain as well as in people's behavior. You know, they measure things like their generosity. Maybe you've come across some of those studies. So unlike anger and attachment, compassion is a rational state of mind. It doesn't exaggerate the positive or negative aspects of a person or an object or a situation. And, of course, when genuine compassion is present, then it influences our other thoughts and emotions and can overpower other negative states of mind that we might be experiencing. In fact, when genuine compassion is present, then it influences all of our other thoughts and emotions. Yeah. So I love this point that it's an interesting paradox of compassion that we, the people who are generating compassion, are the greatest beneficiaries by practicing it. And so I think that's worth noting, really taking note of. In a lot of our Lam Rim topics, we see this pattern of first we look at the benefits of cultivating a positive state of mind, and then we look at the actual methods for cultivating that. And so this can help us to have some interest. You know, actually, when we meditate on the positive aspects or the benefits of something, that helps us to generate faith in that that particular state of mind. And then that leads to developing the wish to, you know, the aspiration to develop it ourselves. And that also gives energy then to us for us to put in the hard yards to bring it about in our mind. And then we get the benefit of that. So compassion makes us happier by practicing it. And I was sharing with the community this morning when I was doing the motivation that we've had a very busy last few weeks. We've had 3 retreats almost back to back. We've been quite busy. And I put my hand up to do this review because no one else did. And I was dragging my heels a little bit yesterday when I started to prepare it. And as soon as I started working with this material on compassion, I noticed that my mind started to become more upbeat and my energy returned. And so it made me happier. And I was happy to have the opportunity to work on it. Compassion, cultivating compassion, gets us out of our usual head full of anxieties and worries and disappointments and regrets. So that's something to keep in mind. When we notice those habitual states of mind that aren't so beneficial, we can notice right there, this is not a cause of happiness. I can change my mind right now to really take note of that. I can change my mind right now I can think about all the people who are having similar negative states of mind and do some taking and giving. Or I can just wish for them to be free of suffering. We can make our mind positive in that moment. Compassion is a great antidote to self-criticism and crippling feelings of shame, which seem to be quite prevalent in this day and age. It may seem counterintuitive, but compassion makes us more optimistic because, as I said, although it's focused on suffering, it includes this positive wish to alleviate the suffering, as well as the possibility of doing something to help others or ourselves in that suffering. Compassion gives us a sense of purpose beyond our habitual self-obsessions. I really appreciated that Geshe Dodol hammered that. Well, hammered's maybe a little bit too strong, but he mentioned many times self-obsession, what were the other terms he used? Do you remember?
Self-concern.
Self-interest. Selfishness. Self-preoccupation. And specifically in that context, he was talking about bodhicitta. We were talking about the praises of bodhicitta and the wonderful qualities of bodhicitta. But compassion, especially great compassion, is an element of developing bodhicitta, so it applies here as well. Compassion lightens our heart and gives us a sense of ease and comfort in our body and mind. I know that's true for me. When I've had a compassionate motivation for something I've done, then even if the action doesn't turn out so well, I can feel at ease within myself because at least I started with a good motivation. However, if I didn't start with a good motivation, then those are the things that wake me up at 3 a.m. How about you? You know, I think, oh, somehow there's dis-ease. There is a lack of ease in the body and mind. With compassion, we become more understanding and patient with ourselves as well as with others. It has an element of tolerance with it. And compassion gives us an alternative to anger and self-hate and other reactive states. It is a marvelous antidote to self-hate. I'm convinced of this. Compassion makes us feel less lonely and less afraid. Why do you think that's the case?
You think of everybody.
You think of everybody? It's more connecting, isn't it? Yeah, compassion connects us. We think about others outside of ourselves. Less lonely, less afraid. It actually makes us more resilient to life's ups and downs. I don't know much about this SEALs, social and emotional learning that Geshe Dodol has been working on developing and is now implementing in schools all around the United States, actually all around the world. But how wonderful that we're making this kind of education accessible to young, many, many more young people. In fact, Jen's going to take that back to Australia and put it to work. Compassion can provide a moral compass to our lives. That's something that can't be underestimated as a value. Research has shown that training in compassion also enhances the immune system and increases the body's healing response. Some of the early work that Richard Davidson did, I have to stop every time I think about it. Which way does it go? Richard Davidson did. They were inducing little blisters on people's arms. I don't know how they did that, but little tiny blisters. But then they had people meditate on compassion. And sure enough, statistically significant differences were seen in the research, even with people just meditating for a short period of time. In fact, in this book I was looking at, I think it's called Altered States, he and a couple of other authors really looked at, a meta search to see what is the research like on these states of mind like compassion, love, mindfulness, those sorts of things, to kind of separate the chaff from the grain. There are a lot of research papers out there that aren't so tight. You know, they have holes in them. They didn't get all the research, all the things that they were measuring for. And anyway, they're just holes in them. And so he was pulling together a lot of the best research that he could find. I haven't read much of the book, but why did I bring that up? Oh, yeah. Just that he was pulling this information together. So I do recommend that book. Altered Traits. Thank you. Altered Traits. Yeah.
The little blisters, then the statistical difference in what?
That they healed faster. Sorry. Thank you. Uh-huh. Thank you for that follow-up. I have a lot of short trains tonight, so help me connect them to the caboose. Thank you.
I wonder, I don't know if you have heard that I read just recently that there's this research to successful research when, or meta search, when patients in a hospital have been given the task to take care of plants within their room, and compared to patients who had plants in their room but somebody else took care of it, like the nurses, then the chances when they took care of it themselves that they healed faster.
Mm.
So I wonder if that's also a form of compassion or caring for something else, you know, getting out of yourself, caring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other thing is what maybe you know, or I don't know, Valmajigma, when you have faced a situation and somebody gets injured, not thinking about a big accident, maybe something, your cat, her tail gets squeezed between a door and a frame, or, you know, somebody really cuts deeply into the finger, then, like myself, I have experience that it goes through my whole body. That's like something like adrenaline, or like it comes, starts in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered, what is that? You know, it's not like I'm lamed or something. It's just there's a strong feeling with, kind of.
You're injured?
No, the cat. Like, let's say the cat is...
response.
Yeah, my response.
It's probably adrenaline.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah, I heard some people have that. Even here in the community shared that.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Good to know.
Yeah. And what I was sharing earlier is a good reminder that we can make a mental note that, you know, it's certainly wonderful to feel that empathy, but also to move it to the next stage to developing compassion. I remember now why I was bringing up this book, because I mentioned that a lot of this evidence was a lot of these results were evident even in people who were meditating for a short period of time. There was something in the book that mentioned even someone who's meditated on compassion for 7 minutes, there are noticeable changes within their body chemistry and their mental, whatever they're measuring. I'm sorry, I don't have the specifics of that, but I thought that was quite interesting, just 7 minutes of compassion. So we may not have a half hour or longer, but even just putting our mind on compassion for a few minutes can be quite beneficial. Okay. So compassion wishes to alleviate suffering. And as human beings, we all experience sufferings. Perhaps we've faced a lot of difficulty in our lives. I know... we've certainly all heard a lot of stories among ourselves as well as people who come to the Abbey. Maybe we've had a difficult home environment or emotional neglect as children, poverty, discrimination, addiction, various things. Maybe experiencing more than what we felt was our fair share of suffering in life. And even in the best of circumstances, you know, maybe good home life and upbringing, good education or job opportunities, we still find difficulties in our lives. Not getting what we want on a daily basis, getting what we don't want, being separated from what we like, in addition to the realities that all of us face, like aging, sickness, the eventuality of our own death. So I think it's interesting to think about our experience of suffering and dissatisfaction. So Venerable uses the term dukkha rather than suffering. because it's a larger, it encompasses more things, not just the ouch kind of suffering, but also the dissatisfaction that we experience on a daily basis. If I said to you, our experience of suffering and dissatisfaction is not necessarily because we're doing something wrong, but rather to a large degree, suffering and dissatisfaction are just part of the conditions of samsara. Would you agree with that? Yeah. I think that can be a big relief. And this is, I think, one of the benefits of the discussion groups that we do here at the Abbey, especially on Sharing the Dharma Day, where we actually exchange with each other. We answer questions and exchange with each other and find out that we have a lot in common, both in terms of our suffering, but also in terms of our joys and things that we find helpful in our lives. So the typical list, one typical list that we find, the Buddha described these different levels of suffering, the out-suffering that we probably most strongly think of when we think of that term, suffering or dukkha. But there are these subtle, more subtle levels of suffering that are in the background, constantly there with us, that we may not label as suffering, and yet they bring a certain ambiguity or unsettledness or the suffering of change, the dukkha of change, for instance, is the fact that our happiness changes, our happiness, what we label happiness, the feelings of happiness or pleasure, they are constantly changing. Just when we get things the way we like them, they change. And that, I like this term that I think I heard it from Venerable Pema Chodron. She talked about the subtle fundamental ambiguity of being human. And it's talking about this impermanence and the lack of any solid security that we can really hang on to. And that's always in the background. And probably if we were able to really tune into that, you know, we'd find there's a certain hum, a certain anxiety that hangs out in the back of our mind because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. The other day in the stand-up meeting in your motivation, Venerable Losung, when you mentioned, you know, we may not get a precious human rebirth in our next life, and it was just like almost a shock. And I appreciated you saying it. It was a good reminder, you know. So not only in this life, but even in our future lives, we don't know what's going to happen next. And that can bring a certain uncertainty, which is not comfortable. So this is another level of suffering or dukkha that we can develop, we can cultivate compassion for in ourselves as well as all other living beings. We all share this. And also the most subtle level of suffering or dukkha is the very fact that we're not in control of our mind, rather the habitual afflictions, karma are in control. And Venerable Chinni highlighted this the other day in her BBC, talking about, you know, when we experience anger, when we get angry with somebody, we're really not in control. And that's hard to admit, isn't it? It's hard to admit. And how beneficial it would be to train our minds to have that as a natural reaction when someone is angry with us or short with us or irritated with us is to remember, currently in this moment, this person is not in control. This is, you know, one of the subtle levels of suffering that we deal with as sentient beings. So these are the very things that we're developing compassion for. We're wishing to remove the suffering of ourselves and all sentient beings and the causes of those sufferings. So not just the ouch, that's so obvious, but even these more subtle, ambiguous sorts of background types of suffering. So chances are pretty good that we've all experienced one or more of these types of suffering in the last week. Would you agree? And what did you find was your habitual response? Now, I'm among a group of practitioners, so we could all give the perfect answers, but be honest. What was your response to the suffering that you experienced the past week? Yeah.
This week I was involved in a car accident. Oh. And I wasn't badly hurt, but I was rear-ended at a school zone, and I'd stopped for a child in the crosswalk.
I say that because I felt that I was quite innocent. And here I was preserving this child's life and obeying the law and being such a good citizen, and yet I got slammed. And the boy who hit me, he was a student in high school. When I approached his car, I said, can we talk? And he said, I come from a wonderful family.
Interesting.
And I was very, and the thing is, I was annoyed by that. But I kind of watched the way my emotions went up and down, feeling like, who would hit me? Oh, I said, okay, I'll be patient. And then him saying, I come from a wonderful family, which soon proved to be that he didn't want me to file an insurance claim. He wanted me to trust his father to pay for the repair of the car. So he's trying to convince me that I was dealing with a good person here, which I found, as I say, enormously annoying. But
annoyed.
I would gladly go into my social justice tirade. The pain on one hand, it did hurt. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, understanding how when you're 17 getting into an accident, it's going to set your premiums through the roof. And just all of those things that I found that I really had to go back and forth. There were moments where I felt really compassion for him. And I learned that he lived with his grandfather and his grandmother has just died and he doesn't know where his parents are and all that stuff. So I was, it was sort of an experience of the back and forth. But I did find that every time I was able to think about him and his grandfather and how this could be really upsetting to them, my back didn't hurt quite as badly. But then every time I thought about how well I was driving and, heck, I just got my car fixed, my back really hurt a whole lot more. So it just felt like my body was reacting to what my mind was putting out. It didn't cause the injury to get angry, but it made it worse. There was a definite connection to how that emotion worked out.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Anyone else?
Pushing the suffering away, and then the wish to retaliate at what I've labeled as the cause of the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the immediate reaction. That's just right there.
Yeah.
And hearing words that I don't want to hear, then there's the aversion, or there's the indignation, and then there's the wish to retaliate, or the thoughts that are like that, and then there's the mind that kicks in and starts to work with it.
Yeah.
When you're trying to work with the afflictions on a daily basis, trying to be mindful of it, and then you lose your cool or something, do something that's just become overwhelmed by an affliction. That's very painful. And then, because that's the mind under the power of afflictions. And for me, the tendency is there to then to ruminate on it a lot, be upset with myself, be upset with the other part of the situation and whatever, And just there's a real tendency to go the wrong way with it sometimes, especially with self-criticism and with the self-criticism comes the wanting to blame something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Less serious, but still dukkha is like the feeling of being bored is quite painful, but it's not so painful in the physical way. It's just, so my reaction typically is, let me distract myself. That's of course the first thing, but not necessarily the most skillful means of dealing with it. But often in order to avoid that kind of mental rumination, it's like just looking for a new distraction.
I tend to see permanence, I always think, oh, here it is again. I'm never going to be free of suffering.
Mm.
It's always going to be here. There's nothing I can do. Poor me. So I go right into depression and discouragement usually.
Venerable Simke and I did a short class, 4-week class at the CREATE Center in Newport, and we asked this question. And some of the responses were, how dare they? And blaming others, so that's come up. Feeling fearful or helpless, getting angry, Asking why me? No one said that. We know why me. numbing out, pushing our suffering away. Now, I'm sure there are many others, but that's a pretty good start. But if we take a moment to check up, do any of these responses actually help us? Several of you have already said these responses didn't help. In fact, they made things worse, didn't they? Yeah. So this is one reason that compassion is a reasonable response in the face of suffering. So in those situations that you've shared, just take a moment to think if you had applied compassion for yourself or for the other person, how that might have turned out differently.
Keep the heart open as opposed to it closing, shutting mm-hmm. down.
For example, when I was at the climate strike and there was this mayor talking, and he was saying...
the mayor of Spokane?
Yeah, of Washington. The governor.
Oh, also. The governor of the state.
Yeah, and he said things that has been contrary to what he is doing. And so I got irritated and a bit angry because there have been 2,500 children who were listening, you know. And he's saying things like, I support you, please continue. That was nice words, but what he himself...
In support of the smelter.
So and then I recognized that I could not listen to him anymore mm-hmm. because I had this inner dialogue and frustration going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you had been able to switch your mind to a compassionate response to yourself, first of all, and then maybe to him?
Yeah, then for sure. I mean, just compassion, understanding, you know, where he comes from, having mm-hmm. taking his perspective that I can't understand yet what really his... reasons are?
I think one of the biggest teachings that I'm beginning to learn is that to have a compassionate attitude doesn't mean you don't do anything.
Yes.
You know, that was one of the status quo thinkings that I had, that if I was going to cultivate compassion and let go of the anger and the victimhood, I would basically be standing there just not bothering to respond. So as time goes on and being in this community and learning that compassion can have an extremely powerful impact, that it can come from a place of power, a place of engagement, mm-hmm. a place of fearlessness and courage, is then it's a lot more doable, activating mind for me, rather than the way I used to misunderstand it and just sort of collapse on myself, almost like, well, I'm going to offer the victory to them. You know, I'm going to see their suffering and what to do. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that the teachings that we've been getting more and more is that compassion can be an extremely engaging and extremely assertive mm-hmm. mind without the anger, but with a lot of energy to it as well.
Yeah.
There's two things about compassion to anger. One is, in order to respond to the situations with compassion, I need to be having it before the situation began. Right? I need to be cultivating a mind that is looking for the kindness of others or you know, is really, really working that as the base so that when I do get triggered, that I'm coming from that place already. Mm-hmm. And then what I have also discovered is that I cannot get from anger to compassion in a flip. Mm-hmm. I have to get to a neutral mind. Uh-huh. And getting to a neutral mind is an act of compassion, but, you know, that is the practice. And then uh-huh. afterwards, then I can, you know, not in order not to hold the grudge or, you know, then I can work on the compassion piece. Mm-hmm. But for me, even just getting to neutral as quickly as possible is a practice.
Yeah. And that's a way of antidoting the anger, isn't it? At least temporarily.
Question on that point of why do we need to get to the neutral mind? If positive states of minds counteract the negative states of minds, why can't we just flip?
I'll say what I think, and then others, please, you're welcome to join in.
But when they talk about in the minds and mental factors that the virtuous positive states of minds are the direct antidotes or the counteractions to the negative states of mind. So I'm just curious about why we can't why we have to go to the neutral before going, like, why can't we just go from the a negative to the positive? If bringing in that positive is an antidote to the negative, why is this step of getting to a neutral state of mind?
I think it's an Ethics for a New Millennium, where His Holiness lays out this analogy that if we watch our minds carefully, and he gives the challenge, please do this, that the negative emotions flow like a cascading river down a beautiful waterfall without any effort whatsoever. And that our virtuous minds are, you know, I can't remember if it's like rolling a rock up a hill, but something. That's his analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's his analogy. So,
upstream,
yes, our familiarity with the negative state of mind, our habit of responding with anger, our capacity for being overwhelmed by our afflictions due to, you know, beginningless time familiarization with that is huge, at least I will speak for myself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when Shanti Deva says at the very beginning of that text, you know, once in a great thing through 1,000 conditions coming together and through the power of a single flash of lightning, the virtuous thought appears in the mind. That's kind of what we're working against. So indeed, I think the fact that when we talk about the fact of a virtuous or a positive mind overwhelming a negative mind, it's true because of the basis. But as long as I believe in my exaggeration of the harm, then, I mean, that I have to start there. I have to start with not believing what I think when I'm exaggerating the negative qualities of the thing that I'm projecting on and responding and think is going to harm me. So I think that's why. It's one reason why.
I think it's also fair to say that there can come a point where you can counter. You're so familiar with the positive states of mind.
Yeah, exactly. Familiarization is the point. Well, no, I mean, I think that your studies are fantastic. 7 minutes of compassion meditation changes the reaction. Mm-hmm. 30 minutes a day for 2 weeks or something. I mean, the studies are amazing.
Yeah. So, they're compelling.
Yeah, and they are very compelling. And, you know, to eliminate them, we have a long way to go. And to make it our habit as opposed to responding habitually in the old way, we also have some work to do. But it's doable, utterly doable.
Someone online says, we can't just flip because we have a biochemical freight train moving as a result of anger. We need to bring quiescence, then compassion.
Thank you.
That's a good point, that certain chemicals are released in the brain that don't just get flushed out.
Yeah, not only a mental reaction, but a physiological one as well.
Yeah.
Kind of what I wanted to say, it's like a process, and sure, the chemistry is going to go take its time, but also the thoughts take time. And actually, when you're having one thought and then you're going to uproot it with another thought that's opposite, that doesn't just happen like flipping a switch. Mm-hmm. And actually, when you watch your mind doing it, there's actually a part of your mind that doesn't believe it, and so you have a corner of your mind that's like, you know, not bought in. And you're cultivating, you know, it's kind of like fabricated at some, you know, that's why I'm with Venerable Trinity. It helps me to get my mind to neutral first, so I'm not having to work against the freight train. But I see it, I mean, my experience is that it's a process, and you have to, there's a number of thoughts that you usually have to work through you have to even actually figure out what you're thinking. And what you're feeling, too. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like you could say love is the opposite of hate when you haven't actually recognized fully what your hatred is, what it's about, what it's doing, you know. And then you have to, there's probably like 20 things going into that, and all these causes and conditions. You've got to, like, weed some of those things out, even to, like, to actually buy in fully to the opposite as an attitude. Mm. There's a lot of thoughts that have to support that. So maybe say you're angry at you get angry at a person and then you see them as fully negative. Well, you have to unroot a lot of that, and you have to bring up their good qualities, and there's a lot you have to do to throw that out. It's not like flipping a switch. I mean, we have a lot of thoughts that are some that are good and some that aren't, but we have a lot of them. I think you have to work through a number of them to actually settle something so you've convinced yourself. I think more of thinking at like advantages and disadvantages is almost an easier way to think of it because that's more complex than just like, you know, hot and cold.
Even hot and cold is a progression, isn't it? Like turning on the heat, it takes a while to fill up the room. Yeah.
So in the school playground, I've sometimes seen children will have some sort of a problem or an issue or a fight. And for me, it's unskillful when teachers make children apologize straight away because the emotion, the feeling of being sorry isn't there. Mm-hmm. So what I do after all these years of teaching is I just listen to each child and I give each one their space. And then I say, all right, I want you two to go over there and I want you to talk about it alone, together, and see if you can work it out. You know, and I just sort of watch them a little bit from the corner of my eye. But for me as a child, I still remember too that feeling of having to apologize when I wasn't ready for it or it didn't feel right. It just feels so wrong to do that. So it's like that freight train idea. You know, you're in one emotion and somebody is telling you, no, you have to have another emotion now, and it doesn't feel authentic and that doesn't feel right.
I just have a clarifying question. I don't think we're advising to go to negative and then linger there, right? Or sorry, not negative, neutral, and then linger in neutral. Or I'm just curious, and like, because I don't have, I could see the rationale that that Venerable Tarpa posed, and that has also come up a few more times, that things don't immediately shift and that there's kind of a progression, kind of how you were saying, from hot to cold, and maybe a neutral is like a necessary passageway. But are we saying that you should linger in the neutral until you're more aware, like Venerable Tarpa was saying, of some of the thoughts that are going on before shifting? Or are we saying that as soon as you get to neutral, then you should use that as a springboard?
You know, I think it's as unique as each person and each situation. And there may be times where, you know, the advice, take 10 breaths when you feel yourself getting angry. Maybe 10's not enough for you that day or that with that situation. Maybe you need 100. Or maybe you just need one because you don't want to go there. You know what it's going to lead to and you're just going to cut it right there. You just, like Venerable Jigme says, drop it, you know. So it depends.
There have been times when I've been able to just, you know, bring up the antidote and go with it. But there's times when you have to go to that neutral space to be able to access the antidote. And yeah, sometimes you might linger there and take a few breaths, and sometimes that's not necessary.
I wondered if it's a matter of what we label neutral to, because it sounds to me a lot like we're applying compassion to ourselves. Just the recognition of anger. And we are the ones suffering the most. I think it's very clear. And then just stopping and, yeah, getting down to, like what you said, it's so, I nonviolent communication helps me tremendously because it stops me from shaming myself. I just know that's not going to go anywhere. It just adds to the anger. So, hey, here's some anger and here are some needs that I'm believing are not going to get met. And that's why I'm behaving like a 3-year-old because I think I'm not going to get whatever survival need it is. And you know what? You're not 3 anymore. It's okay. Yeah. But I have to go through that process myself. I do think that's compassion. I can't direct it outwards yet, but it has to start here. And I'm like, whoa. A lot of wrong thinking that's kind of panicking. And I need to deal with my suffering with a lot of kindness.
Yeah. So if we were to freeze frame each situation, then we could see, well, how many moments are actually neutral? And where does the compassion for self start? And minimal.
I was going to say the same thing. I don't think there's such a thing as neutral, really. I think it's turning the mind toward what you know is going to be nourishing and beneficial. And it's just getting that momentum going, I think. At least in my own mind, I don't feel a neutral, like you were saying, a stopping place. That's not what it feels like. It's feel the pain of what I'm experiencing, then I'm going to move it because I feel the pain. And so it's compassion.
Well, it's interesting to look at our own experiences and then contrast that to what we find in some of the Buddhist literature, because I know in the six steps of preparing, what's it called? Six preparatory steps for meditation. The last one, I think, is to, you, at some point, you're checking your mind to see, is it positive? It's not. If it's not positive, if it's negative, then you bring it to neutral. That's the advice. What is it?
It's setting the mind. That's a physical posture. It's the mind.
Yeah. Right, that's where it comes with the 7-point Vairochana posture, and actually there's an 8th step where you check your mind and see, is it positive, negative, or neutral? Or if it's negative, then you're advised to bring it to a neutral state and then cultivate positive state of mind. So maybe that's some of the lingering idea of, we have about, but it would be interesting to notice more of that gap of, well, where is there a neutral mind, and where am I actually applying self-compassion? Of saying, I'm not going to indulge the anger, so what can I do, even if that's taking a breath, which is a kind of a neutral activity, you know, without a strong positive motivation, it's a neutral activity that just brings some space in between going down the old path, the cascade, and forging a new boulder up the hill, as it were. Yeah.
I guess I experience a moment of neutrality there when I, if I stop and sometimes I stop and take a breath, and there's also a letting go. It's like, just let go of it, and I tell myself that. And then I feel myself shifting to a positive mental state. Mm-hmm. But there is, yeah, maybe it is somewhere from going from the one extreme to another, is going through some kind of a neutral thing, but just being, letting go before I can really apply an antidote or move my mind to a virtuous thing. And that letting go is no longer really negative, but it hasn't moved to a positive state quite yet.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading about His Holiness going to address what we'll say is a sophisticated European audience with high expectations of what the message was going to be. And he spent the next hour or so telling them basically that repeating again and again, just like me, they want to be happy. Just like me, they don't want to suffer. And that was the message. Quite simple, but, you know, he's excellent at knowing what his audience needs. And I find that saying those little, would you call them mantras, I suppose, or little sayings or quotes, I just keep repeating those again and again in my head, and they just seem to be popping up more and more just by repeating them, because they're quick and they're meaningful and they're right to the point.
Mm-hmm. There's a book by Dr. Kristen Neff called Self-Compassion, and there's a wonderful little practice in the book for cultivating self-compassion that I, at one point in my life, I found very helpful to keep in mind. And it's like a mnemonic or something that you keep in mind. And the first point is just to acknowledge that there's suffering. That alone, it requires a lot of awareness, doesn't it? Oh, this is suffering. And from a Buddhist point of view, we could even say, this is suffering of samsara. And everyone experiences it, you know. This is suffering. What's the second step? Oh, yeah, the second step is everyone experiences suffering, so that it gets it out of that narrow focus, that narrow tunnel of self-interest. Everyone experiences suffering, something like that. And then the third and the fourth step, the third step is, how can I be mindful in this moment? Which is kind of like what we're talking about. How can I just breathe or take a moment to be with this before I go to the next step? And then for her, the fourth step was, how can I bring compassion to myself in this moment? And then that could lead to compassion for others in the situation too. But just having that practice of self-compassion can also be quite a powerful. It's like taking all those moments of what's happening. Oh, they're suffering. Okay. And that really, if we're angry, we're stopping that process, that's probably what we're doing, because we've all experienced the suffering of anger. And we know where it leads, and it doesn't go anywhere good. And yeah, just to acknowledge, okay, this is suffering, and everyone experiences this. This is a human part of the common humanity. and then how to be mindful with it and how to actually be moved to compassion with it. I was reminded that in his book, Fearless Heart, Thupten Jinpa pointed out that we may fear becoming more compassionate. You remember this? Because we might worry that if we become too compassionate with others, they will take advantage of us. So these are some of the misconceptions that may be out there about compassion. Or if we become too compassionate with ourselves, we'll just become self-indulgent slackers. Have you ever had that? You know, there is a fine line between self-indulgence and self-compassion, and sometimes it's hard to know which way we're going with it. But it's true, and you brought this up, Venerable Simke, and that's acting with true compassion involves some wisdom of how to help, knowing that one behavior is not suitable for all occasions or one response is not suitable for all occasions. In some situations, being compassionate or acting compassionately, motivated by compassion, may involve sharing our time and our energy, our presence, our listening skills, even our possessions, whatever is called for in the situation. But at other times, we may show real compassion by saying no, by setting boundaries, by being very clear about our needs or our feelings and needs, or supporting others to take responsibility for their own lives, not demanding, but supporting, even if they become angry with us in the short run. So that requires a lot of wisdom in that regard. It's also, I think, a good reminder that compassion is something that we give freely without expecting something in return. Any pleasure we experience comes from the compassionate actions, not from any appreciation or recognition we can get. And sometimes that's a little tricky too. Often, I think it's fair to say, often our compassion may be mixed with meeting our own needs. I want to be seen as a compassionate person, not a caring person, rather than a genuine wish to engage in that moment. Acting with compassion towards others means seeing others as equal to us. We are all human beings who want happiness and don't want suffering. That's an important piece. And sometimes the most compassionate thing we can do is to teach others how to solve their own problems or to give them the support to solve their own problems or to encourage them to solve their own problems and get out of the way so that they can do it. And I think it's also a good reminder that we have to be careful not to get more involved than the person really wants us to be. Sometimes that can happen. Or inadvertently making the other person feel inept or powerless because we're helping and we're stepping in more than they may want us to. So in addition to learning what compassion is, it's equally important to be clear about what it's not. And a lot of this comes from Venerable and Russell's book, An Open-Hearted Life. You know, we may think of compassion as pity or feeling sorry for others, thinking, poor you, I feel sorry for you, while holding a condescending attitude that thinks, it's a shame you're not as together as I am. Sometimes that can creep in. Or we may think that compassion means creating a world where everything is perfect, where everyone holds hands and sings kumbaya, or that compassion means being above it all, you know, having a serene state of mind and moving through life unscathed, unaffected by difficulties, and where we can magically impart our wisdom to others so that they can completely turn their lives around. Have you ever had that thought? If I could just say the right thing, it would just change everything, as if there's one condition.
Like an aspiration that we're encouraged to carry on, like being able to get through to sentient beings with just like one, you know, well-timed sentence.
Yes, but I think, you know, it's a whole spectrum, isn't it? So I'm talking about probably the end that has a lot of misconception to it. You know, we're being unrealistic about the situation. As opposed to developing the compassion and the wisdom that can actually engage in that way and be effective in that way. Yeah, but there's a lot of learning in between. Yeah, aspiration's great. Or we may think that to be compassionate, we have to become people pleasers. That's so humbling to recognize in oneself, isn't it? And yet, yeah, so I think especially women are trained to be people pleasers. Maybe that's a stereotype we have to throw out. Or we may think that compassion gives us permission to interfere in others' lives and try to fix all their problems. Boy, that's a trap. Never mind that we can't fix our own, but we're going to try to fix theirs, right? So real compassion doesn't mean becoming the world's doormat. We've heard that phrase, idiot compassion. Maybe that's a bit strong. Unskillful compassion might be a better way to say it. So if we really check up to see what might be motivating these erroneous ideas of compassion, I think that's a worthy area to reflect on so that we're aware of what some of our habitual ways of thinking are, or some of our unmet needs that we're trying to meet by being compassionate with others. So if you just take a moment to think about those for yourself, what is it that your compassion gets mixed with that makes it a little bit unclear? Probably self-cherishing is across the board for all of us. But in addition, we'll probably each have our own unique afflictions, or maybe matching things up with our conditioning as children or young people, things like that. It's worth giving some time to. Maybe even shoring up our own self-esteem, our own sense of self-worth. If we help others, then naturally we're going to feel better about ourselves. Yeah.
There's fear comes in sometimes too. We're compassionate, but if it means that it's going to threaten our family or there's some danger to us and our loved ones, then we may not act in a compassionate way because we could be threatened, our home or our safety, mm-hmm. things like that.
Microphone confusion.
So often personal distress comes up in the context of compassion mm-hmm. as something that's a near enemy, or it can feel like when we act out of personal distress to help somebody else because we feel badly, it can feel like compassion, but actually it's we just feel uncomfortable and it may not be what's best for them. And I have an example of when I saw a cat at the Abbey and it was begging for food, and I knew I wasn't supposed to give it food, but I just felt so badly for the cat that I gave it to it anyway. And I really thought I was being compassionate in that moment. But when I look back, I realize it was really about my own feeling, because the cat was fine, you know, it would have survived.
Yeah, it's a daily occurrence. So we know it's not actual starvation. Yeah.
I just appreciated the examples you brought up because, you know, it's for me, the compassion gets mixed up with arrogance very much. You know, the idea of, oh, I got to have it together to help someone else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of how His Holiness responded when the Western teachers, the Western monastics shared with him their situation, right? Jetsuma mm-hmm. said, you know, their health problems, visa problems, many Western monastics disrobe. They have such a sincere motivation, but the conditions are not there. And he just wept. And then he was very clear of his limitations, and he said, please, go help yourselves. Mm-hmm. I will support you as far as you can. But he wasn't like, I will now fix all your problems. Or, I think he was very clear what he can and can't do as a refugee.
Yeah, actually, right? That's a good point, that we need to be really honest in assessing what we can do and what we can't do.
And that it's a compassionate thing to do.
Right? Yes.
To not pretend like there's no problem, or that I am the expert and I will somehow wave a magic wand.
Yeah. Or I will go above and beyond what I can possibly do realistically.
2 years ago, Solinas was in Frankfurt teaching, and then at the end there was a Q&A, and a young woman came up and she was mentally in distress, and she mentioned different personal and environmental reasons for that. And she was crying in front of him, saying, begging him, please help me. And then he said, as long as space endures, as long as living being remains, until then I will remain to dispel the mystery of the world.
Oh, beautiful.
Mm.
Yeah.
He gave her a very secure picture.
A what?
A picture that gives her some security.
One time His Holiness was in Australia and he was giving a public talk, and for extenuating circumstances, I had to give my ticket away and go help somebody. I didn't actually hear I wasn't there for the talk, but I heard at this talk that a woman approached the stage and was in a lot of distress, And His Holiness just went right over her to her and embraced her in the biggest bear hug and just held her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has quite a lot of capacity.
He's had wisdom. His security people would have been quite alarmed by that, wouldn't they? Because he has a lot of security people around him.
I don't know how they responded to that.
They would have been.
Yeah, they're probably used to it. Yeah. So, yeah.
But he's got a wisdom at the level.
Yeah. Yeah, he knows what's required in the meeting, in the moment.
When we're trying to help someone too, whether it's whether we're trying to just give them some advice or say the right thing or do something to help their situation, we have to be careful that our motivation is not just to be changing our outer circumstances that we have to deal with. We have to have a balance between working inside on ourselves and not trying to tweak everything that's outside of ourselves. Because, well, like somebody had said, we might just be uncomfortable with it, you know, like Marimal Kunga had said. Mm-hmm. And then it comes down to us just trying to change our outer circumstances and labeling that as compassion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, help this person so their problem goes away and then I don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it's like that.
Yeah, or we given someone advice, we want them to help them so they'll change, so we don't have to deal with their behavior.
We don't have to look at their suffering. Yeah,
yeah, or their behavior and our own, how it makes us suffer. Even we just have to, and we're ordinary beings in samsara. We're going to have mixed motivations. We need to appreciate and rejoice in the good part of our motivations too.
Yeah. And I appreciate what Venerable Chuni said earlier, which is that we need to be cultivating compassion on the cushion way ahead of time and thinking about the kindness of others and to prepare so that in those moments we have something on board that we can draw on. There's a section in An Open-Hearted Life where Russell Colt says that compassion is not airy-fairy. It's not pretentious. It doesn't mean being comfortable and sweet all the time. Isn't that a relief? And it certainly is not an excuse to see ourselves as better than others. Compassion is not just repeating clever platitudes to smooth things over. Silver lining, I think that's what Lachelle would call that. Being compassionate requires a willingness to contact the messy stuff of life, the physical, emotional, and mental pain and suffering and dissatisfaction, our own and that of those we want to help. Being compassionate takes incredible courage to be fully present in the face of unpleasant experiences and feelings and emotions and the slow going of finding a reliable way to work with it. Being a witness to others' suffering can bring up powerful emotions in us too. It can trigger some of our own unresolved issues. For example, it's not uncommon for people to feel very uncomfortable around someone experiencing grief from the death of a loved one. And why is that? Probably because many of us have shied away from, you know, doing the depth of work with our own grief in our life. And now that person's experience is reminding us of our own loss and vulnerability. So, yeah, it's important to honestly assess our capacity for dealing with others' suffering, that specific suffering, whatever it is that's in front of us, and be honest about what we are capable of doing and not doing. And sometimes that can be a relief if someone can just say, I'd love to help you, and I can't right now, or I don't have the capacity, I don't have the skills, but, you know, perhaps we can brainstorm together and find someone who can help you in this situation. Venerable Tarpa.
Brings me back to your earlier question about what is my response sometimes with compassion. And the thing I think where I've made a lot of mistakes was the sense of responsibility that came up. And it's a kind of misplaced where taking responsibility for someone else for things that they should be taking responsibility for, that's the unhealthy thing that I had to discern. You know, yeah, I'm not responsible for their emotions. Let's put it that way. I'm not responsible for their choices. I'm not responsible for the outcomes that they get from their choices, things like that. And that I didn't have that straight. somehow I, yeah, something, well, I think maybe someone had to take care of somebody. But when I was a kid, I was taking care of people and I was too young. So mm-hmm. if you, you know, that's not right.
Yeah.
So you have to undo those things.
Yeah. Right. One of the things that Venerable Children said recently stood out for me. She was talking about when we start something, we need to make sure that we can carry it through for the long term. Do you remember that? And that reminded me of, like, for instance, as monastics, often people will share with us some of their difficulties, either in their life or with their practice. And one of the things that I'm learning to be much more clear about is what I can offer and what I can't offer, what I shouldn't offer. And so in the past, I have been willing to get very involved in talking about people's emotions and what's going on, you know, in that, in the psychological realm, when I'm not a therapist. And it's in a way, it's extending more than I can actually carry through with. You know, this is not my student, for instance. It's a fellow practitioner. And so it's actually a relief and a very, I think, a clarifying point to realize, wait a minute, what I can offer is the Dharma. And if this isn't a situation where I can offer the Dharma, then I need to keep my mouth shut, you know, and not go into that emotional realm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's been a big learning. Otherwise, it kind of sets up a false expectation between me and another person, you know, that then they're going to be expecting something like that again and again, and I have limited capacity or skill, for that matter. So, if we constantly pull away from suffering that we see around us or within us, then it will be difficult for our compassion to grow. I think this was something Russell said. And we can slowly and intentionally learn to tolerate these powerful, uncomfortable emotions so that we can grow our capacity to actually be of help. This is actually something that Shanti Deva has said. Through familiarity, we gain comfort with. So, if you can gain familiarity with small harms, it was in the context of harms, but I think we can apply it here. Yeah, suffering. Then we will build our capacity to be able to bear larger harms. So, this is something that we can think about on a daily basis. This was who was it? Dzongtsar Kensei Rinpoche used this wonderful phrase: "We all have bourgeois suffering." You know, yes. Oh, my laundry came back and I didn't find my socks. That's a bourgeois suffering, okay? You have an example of bourgeois suffering? Or? Oh.
We also say it's a first world problem.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, I think.
Yeah, and if we put it into context, we can see this is really something very small. Geshe Dadal was reminding us not to make big things out of small things. We've heard that a lot, actually. But this is something that we can actually practice. So in the face of small sufferings, we can consciously think, okay, this is a moment of suffering. Can I just be present with this? Can I just experience? Where is it in my body? What thoughts does it bring up? Can I just train with this moment? We can do that with small things throughout the day so that in a way we're building our capacity for the larger things that inevitably will come our way. Ah, right. Everything becomes easier with familiarity, and by becoming acquainted with small sufferings, we can learn to patiently accept greater harms. Okay. So, I think that will conclude our section on love and compassion, cultivating love and compassion, at least for now. I think it comes up again later in the book, and we can look at it in a different light. But hopefully tonight was just a helpful review, maybe it brought some happiness to your mind, as it did mine preparing for tonight. So let's rejoice that, thank you for your participation, and let's rejoice that we had the time to think about compassion. It's such an important positive state of mind, especially in the Buddhist tradition, actually all religious traditions, but especially in the Buddhist tradition. And keeping in mind these different levels of suffering that we're trying to overcome, not just the ouch suffering or dukkha, but these more subtle levels that we're dealing with as spiritual practitioners. That can be quite helpful. So again, just a reminder, I found it's at the end of my notes, this meditation from Kristen Neff. So the first one is, this is a moment of suffering. So when we observe suffering in our own body and mind or in others, we notice, if we notice a desire to turn away from it, we can say, this is a moment of suffering. That's the koan, or the mnemonic, or the mantra. It's important to acknowledge the suffering. This brings mindfulness to the fact that we're experiencing pain or discomfort. And when we observe our own physical or emotional pain or suffering of others, this helps us remember that these moments of suffering are worthy of compassion. Then suffering is part of life. By remembering this, we acknowledge that suffering is part of the shared human condition. We don't need to fight against this fact. This is normal, natural state of affairs. I mean, until we achieve liberation, we don't need to fight against it. One that every other living being also experiences. We're not alone in our experience. And sometimes that acknowledgement alone can really shift our mind. The third, may I be kind to myself in this moment, helps to bring a sense of caring concern to our present experience. And the heart starts to soften when we soothe and comfort ourselves. And then four, may I give myself the compassion that I need. This is likely where we need to start with ourselves, acknowledging that we're worthy of compassion. We're worthy of taking the moment to cultivate compassion. But eventually, when we're well-resourced, we can then move to others. May I give this person the compassion that they need, recognizing that all living beings are worthy of our compassion.